Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. Today we've got Sir Stephen Wilkinson. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, John.
Glad to have you. And so I'm going to let you tell people a little bit about Good and Prosper. What I'm going to tell everyone is that we met, I guess a little more than a year ago or about a year ago, and have worked together and played together and even attended Breakthroughs on the Bayou together. And Sir Stephen is, of course, the thing that I think is so cool is that Sir Stephen is a knight. And not only is he a knight, I've discovered that he is a knight commander. So when you get a room full of knights, Stephen gets to boss most of the other ones around. And luckily, he doesn't really boss people around too much anyway. But Sir Stephen is one of the most chivalrous gentlemen I've ever met. I will admit that after his first note to me, I have had a man crush ever since. And Stephen's got a great background, a very eclectic approach to finance and business and leadership. And so I'm thrilled to have him here to talk with me. Stephen, thanks for coming. And so people can find you at goodandprosper.com.
They can.
And your Twitter handle is at goodandprosper. And tell us a little bit about what your focus is these days.
I think I can best explain what my focus is these days as a, if I tell you what I've been doing for most of my working life, because only then does it make any sense, I think.
Perfect. Perfect.
I started off life with a distinct interest in literature, English literature and German literature, and that's what I studied. And I ended up in finance more by accident and because my family told me in no uncertain terms that when I proposed or told them that I'd been offered a traineeship working for an American company in 1987, a finance institute, a bank, they unanimously said, impossible. There's no way on this earth that you're ever going to have any success or enjoyment in an environment like that, which sort of sealed it for me. And then I did it, which is gives you some indication of my character as well.
So yeah, we're going to do it. So you can't do something and you'll definitely do it.
Yeah, and that tends to work today. It still works today, which is why I'm having great trouble with this lockdown. But maybe that's something we can cover later on in the program. I ended up in finance, found that fascinating, intellectually challenging, and interesting from all sorts of perspectives, which I don't need to go into now. I just found the challenge of understanding this rather strange world with its rather strange language around numbers interesting enough to stay the course. I think I signed on originally for a two-year traineeship, which cost $40,000 or would have cost $40,000 if I had if I'd have broken it off at any one stage. So I had to stay long enough to earn my money back, earn their investment back, which meant I stayed there, I think, for 3 years and left very quickly. Afterwards, went to work for an outstanding German wealth management company as their head of investment policy, which, when I think back on it, I was 27 at the time, was an extraordinary decision for the partners to take, given given what an imposter I thought that I was at that stage. But anyway, they did it. And you know, because I've told you that there was one point about 3 or 4 months into into my first sort of time at that wealth management company, when I was sitting, I think it was a summer evening. I think I started in June, and it must have been, I don't know, September. It was a late evening, 7 o'clock. I'd been called into the senior partner's office, who happened to be a good friend of mine and my then wife's. So he'd sort of taken a double chance hiring me for what for him was an extremely sensitive position. And I was in his study, you know, the sun sort of setting gently about 7-8 o'clock in the evening. Everybody else had left, and I was being torn to shreds. Sitting there, I can picture it now. I get sort of goosebumps thinking about it. Sitting in this chair, having this sort of 5 or 6 page memo that I'd written for him, just being torn to pieces. He was really on a roll, telling me basically I had no idea, I was incompetent, that nobody he'd ever come across had ever written such nonsense, so badly presented. And he just went on and on. And I remember my mind sort of wandering off, because I thought, I'm sure this is going to end sometime. Maybe I won't survive it, and I want to think of some nice things. Thinking, how on earth did I get here? And also thinking, this is going to end so badly, because when I go home tonight, I'm going to have to tell my wife of 3 years that I don't have a job, and that this finance thing is going to come to a horrible end, and I've got to leave the business in whatever my notice period was, probably a couple of weeks. And I was going to have to think of something else to do. And I was in Munich at the time, and just all these thoughts going through my head, and the fact that I was actually really close to tears. You know, I was 27 or 28, and here I was being made to feel like a 6-year-old who has just murdered his sister. You know, it was just awful. Anyway, so coming back, he sort of came back as he was sort of winding down, and he picked up this piece of paper where I had handwritten this column of numbers, about 20 of them. I really can't remember what it was anymore, but it was something with a lot of numbers. And he held it up in front of me and said, "This is just nonsense. Nobody writes numbers like this. Nobody could put numbers in that messy order." And I said, "This is how you do it." And he sat down and he wrote down all my sort of 20 or 40 numbers. It took him about 10 minutes to write them all down, slammed them on the table in front of me and said, "That's how you write numbers down. And that's how you write numbers, because that's why we use squared paper in this job, so that the numbers can go in the right columns and they are underneath each other." And I remember thinking two things at the time. Number one, he's not going to fire me, because he wouldn't be taking all that trouble to explain something as basic as that if he was going to fire me, because why would he bother? He would just send me out to do my damage in the rest of the world with my ignorance. And the other thing I remember thinking at the time was, I get it. There is an order, a grammar to numbers that I need to respect. And I recognized in that moment the alternate truth was that if it had been words instead of numbers, I would have been equally distressed and equally angry. Now, not because I'm a grammar Nazi, but because numbers and words, or because words need to be treated with respect. That's why we have grammar and syntax and spelling, and there's a right way of doing things and a wrong way of doing things. And because without those laws and regulations around the use of language, it ceases to have the meaning that it needs to convey. And when I realized that that was true of numbers as well, and that there was a whole grammar and syntax and spelling around numbers, I completely changed my attitude, completely. And I wanted to understand it. I wanted to learn those rules of grammar. And I also realized that evening that numbers tell stories. Numbers are a language. You can learn it. And languages are words, and words, we use words to tell stories, and numbers tell stories as well. I just had to learn the language.
Yeah.
And that I suspect, that one incident changed my life, I suppose you could say, because not only did it change my attitude towards the job that I was doing, but it made so much more sense of it. And so for the last 30 years, more or less, 20 years, no, 30. It is horrible to admit, but it is indeed 30 years. I have been sort of wandering around this great hall of finance, feeling always like a poet, always slightly lost, always sort of with one eye for an exit, but never quite managing to find it, and creating my own take and job spec within finance as somebody who has a basically literary storytelling bent. And so to answer your question, what do I do now? I moved from managing other people's money to managing my own balance sheet and investing in small and medium-sized businesses, which was an area that I loved most because it allowed me to do two things. It allowed me to get engaged at a story level with businesses, which I've always much preferred than dealing with the aggregate, although I love financial history and economic history, and I think I'm quite well versed in that. But dealing with individual businesses, particularly human scale businesses, you're fully involved in the story and the narrative of those businesses. And I love that. And the second thing that I enjoy about those businesses is that I can use my own knowledge of finance to act as a sort of translator between the capital world and the operating business world. And I found that a great many entrepreneurs and business owners are not really that well versed in finance. It's not their primary skill set. Some of them, and a lot of them, tend to ignore it. They're not comfortable with their accounts and don't see their financial accounting as being something that is really integral to their job of creating value in their businesses. And I see my job as a sort of Sherpa translator, helping them to understand how they can leverage their own skills by becoming better or rather more financially intelligent within their businesses. And that's what I set up Good and Prosper for. So I'm now coming after a very long excursion through the woods back to the ranch. I set up Good and Prosper as a platform business to see if I could find some way of creating a slightly larger audience for some of the key ideas and models that I've evolved for building financial intelligence for entrepreneurs. So that's what it is. I write occasionally, and I'm writing more and more on the platform because I find that I've missed that tremendously. And I'm creating knowledge models, courses, live and recorded, to enable entrepreneurs, small business owners, people involved in the business world to think in a different way about finance and to help people increase their own financial literacy. Because I just think it makes life easier if you have a solid grasp of finance. Yeah,
I concur. And my experiences with you myself would bear that out, and what I've seen you cause for other people as well. So I love the excursion through the woods. And if you're okay with it, I want to go back, talk about a couple pieces of that, and get any thoughts that you might have if you want them. And then I'd love to talk about a number of other things, this ebook that you have just so graciously sent over to me this morning, just came out, that I'm super excited to talk about. And I would love to talk about a theory that you espouse about communication and leadership. So I think there's some really fun things to talk about still to come, but I do want to go back. And I just want to say that story of you in that office with tears brimming in your eyes, feeling like you were going to get fired, and then the insight that gave you, there are just a lot of leadership lessons in that. And I'll tease out a few of them, and then if you've got anything that you want to add to them or perhaps correct about them, I'd be super happy to hear it. But first of all, my experience when I, and this is something that I find happens all the time, when people really get clear about that story, about where they're coming from. When you shared that story with me for the first time, there's such congruence with people's stories, yours in particular in this case, but in general, there's such congruence between who you are, what you care about, what you bring, what's special about you, and that story. You know, I heard that story and it just was like a whole bunch of major pieces of the puzzle of Sir Stephen Wilkinson just fell into place. And all of a sudden, I felt like I got it. I got you. I got where you're coming from. I appreciated your special angle. you're a chivalrous poet of finance, and I, you know, I, so number one, I fell in love with you, and I think that's the experience that I've watched lots of other people have when they hear that story, and it puts everything in perspective for me about what I can expect from you and where you're coming from. And it gives me, you know, it's one of the things that I call emotional credibility. And that's a book that I'm working on right now. But I think
I have you to thank for the story, because up until the moment when you told me to look for something that, some cathartic event, something that could be described as a bridge in my life over which I had traveled, yeah, and there was the time on the one side of the bridge, and then there's the time on the other side of the bridge. I had to dig quite deeply to find that,
because you did dig deeply. I thought that was very inspiring.
And I would never have, you know, before we started our own process of crafting a speech, which you helped me do brilliantly. I had forgotten it. It wasn't even a story that I thought was a story.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that is something that I see happen a lot. It's one of those things that, I mean, and I've got those things for me too, of course, those moments that absolutely changed my life, but then that became my life and I forgot that it was ever different, you know, and I forgot that I made that decision or had that realization. So I think it's great that you did that and that you found that and that you shared that and shared it so well. Now, the other thing
particularly as I was absolutely convinced that I really didn't have any stories.
Well, and you know, and thank you for saying that, because I know you better now than I did when I first met you, obviously. And you are a man who's full of fabulous, wonderful stories. And not only that, you love to tell them and spin them and really bring the room into them. And people do not ever forget you because of that. And you've got, I think the thing that you see now, maybe more than you did before, is that all those moments that inspired you, that meant something to you, that touched you or moved you or showed you something, all of those are stories that everybody, especially because you've got such a beautiful accent and you tell them so well, just wants to hear. And I think that
only on your side of the pond.
yeah. Well, probably does work better over here. What's the word? Bottle. Anyway. So, you know, but, and anybody that's listening to this who might be thinking, oh yeah, well, you know, he's interesting. He's got an accent. He's got all these cool stories. 'Cause you know, whatever, everybody has those stories. You can't be a human being and get into adulthood and be functioning in society without actually having some interesting.
I can tell you a very short anecdote about,
yes,
that. Something that I do a lot of trail walking, long distance, yes, trail walking. It's my,
and so beautiful,
one of my great passions. And I write while I'm walking, and I've done, you know, a number of long distance, and long distance means sort of 400 to 600 kilometer jobbies. And they are as much an exercise in writing as they are in moving, because I keep a journal and publish it on a blog that, yeah, I just love doing that.
Do you want to give us the address of that?
Yeah, it's peregrinations.eu. Peregrinations, which is a smart word for wandering around and not knowing where you're going. peregrinations.eu. And I've got a couple of long ones, a couple of short ones, and whenever I do an interesting one at home in Ireland, I always pop it up with some photographs and some coordinates so that people can download the map onto their Garmin and do it themselves. Mm. But when I was starting off, I was always wondering. I wanted to make it amusing, because you know it's not terribly serious. I'm not wandering through the Hindu Kush with a Kalashnikov and a camel, so it's not terribly exciting. Yeah. The places that I go to, it's, you know, mostly Europe quite civilized places to be. But I wanted to make it amusing, and I was inspired by Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote an amazing book, a travel book called Travels with a Donkey. And Travels with a Donkey is just him and a donkey walking through the forest of Cévennes in the southeast of France. He started ridiculously in October, which is about the stupidest time you can go walking down there, in the 1830s, 1840s, or whenever it was that he went. He was ill. He had a lung condition. He was never very well. He was best known for his books, you know, Treasure Island and Kidnapped. And he wrote this lovely travel book called Travels with a Donkey. And it's really funny. It's a really funny book. And reading his letters and his diary sort of alongside the book, I discovered a really interesting truth about how to write amusingly when you're writing travel literature.
Mm.
And that is, and he says this, he has this amazing phrase that he says, whether something is amusing or not, whether things very rarely happen to people that are genuinely hilarious, but whether you are able to view yourself through a lens of humor, whether you are able to see the foolishness of your very existence, is the key to writing amusingly about things that happen to you. And I remember taking that with me on my first walk and thinking, you know, that's absolutely true. And I was given an example of it on day one. I remember the very first walk I did was I left on the 6th of January, and it was really wet and stormy, and I planned to walk from the beginning of the Thames, from the source of the Thames, all the way through London and to the mouth of the Thames, which is about 300 kilometers. But it was so wet on that winter that I just couldn't do that walk. The last warning came from the environmental secretary saying the last kilometer of the Thames Valley has been shut for public access, so there's no walk and there's nothing. So I landed in Gatwick, and I had to make up my mind to do something. So I thought, well, I'll go to Wales, because at least they've got a few mountains. It's not that cold, so I can walk on a slightly higher trail and just do that. So I did it, and I was walking. I took a train from central London to Bristol. And while I was at the train station, I went to buy a bottle of water and a newspaper. And as I was walking, and remember, I'd never done this before, and as I was walking to the train, I suddenly thought, fuck, I've lost my suitcase. I've lost my bag. Where's my bag? And I was rushing around the platform trying to find my bag. And I went back to W.H. Smith's, the news agents, and said, have you seen a rucksack that I left here? And the woman behind me just looked at me and said, you mean apart from the one on your back?
Of course.
I sort of went bright red and walked back and hoped that nobody had seen me looking for my case when it was on my back. But I suddenly realized that's what Robert Louis Stevenson meant.
Yes.
The opportunities for humor are everywhere. Yeah. If you're prepared to laugh at yourself.
Yes, yes. Brilliant. And, you know, that's really, really good. And that's something people are always looking for in their speeches and the different presentations that they do, is how can I put humor in? And I think that a guy that I really respect and have worked with and think is just very, very brilliant is a guy named Craig Valentine. And he told me a long time ago, John, you can't put humor into a speech, but you can find the humor that's already there, which I think is what you've said.
Very good. Very good.
You know, so I think that, and that's a great lesson. And I love the illustration. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Now back to that story.
Yes.
That sure. Boss of yours, I think that boss of yours, had some great leadership characteristics. And one of the things that I have been thinking about that story, and one of the things that comes up for me is that, so number one, I feel like a really great leader, when someone screws up, they see the opportunity to teach that person the lesson and keep that person in the organization, because if you've got someone who's a good person and a smart person and they learn that lesson, well, guess what? They're never going to make that mistake again. You know, I think that he was well rewarded for his time chewing you out first, but then not throwing you under the bus, showing you something that really had an impact for you, and then keeping you around, because essentially he was saying you're worthwhile and I believe in you enough that I'm not going to throw you out. And that kind of belief in you, I think, probably spurred you to be one of his best employees ever. What would you say?
I think that is true. That is true. He certainly was an incredibly important mentor on my journey, and I deliberately chosen him because I had a feeling he was going to be really good. I desperately needed somebody who was outstanding at their task, at their craft, to teach me. I was fed up to the back teeth of working with what I saw as being marginally incompetent people in the company, in the bank that I was working with previously. Right. I knew I wanted to master my subject. And I knew in order to master my subject, I had to find a master. I had to find someone who could teach me. And he was all of those things. I don't think I would have any level of the competence that I possibly have today without the grounding that he gave me. And he did it. He was brutal. And he was brutal. There's just no two ways about it. He was brutal. His brutality came from a passion for his craft, that where he felt personally insulted if it was disrespected or just done cack-handedly. So
like I you and Pope?
Yeah, I guess. I get, and numbers now too, because I'm the same. I have the same anal fixation with the correct use of numbers. He also, by the way, told me, was the very first person who told me never to trust numbers just because they come out of a computer.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, wow. I can't tell you how much money that saved me.
That's great.
Because because you know, when I was starting in the late 1980s, now early 90s, computers were becoming ubiquitous, and just because they were coming out of computers and not handwritten or typed, somehow made them more authoritative.
Yeah,
and he was equally brutal about saying just because they've come out of a machine doesn't mean that they are more or less reliable, probably less reliable than if you'd written them by hand.
Yeah,
so. And I've taken that with me all the way.
Well, that's cool. That's fabulous. So the other thing that I would like to talk about, just so we for sure get to it in the time that we have, is your ebook that you've just put out. And you know, I want to acknowledge that at the time that we're recording this, it's, you know, kind of nearing the end of March. The WHO just said that the COVID-19 epidemic is, you know, ramping up. It's getting worse by the day, exponentially. So it's a little bit of a scary time, and I think that, you know, one of the sayings, one of just to quote myself, just to be cheeky, one of my favorite sayings is, "It's easy to be a great leader when it's easy to be a great leader." But that's not when it makes a difference. When it makes a difference is when it's really, really hard to be a great leader. And that's what people, I think, need now. And that's the situation that we're in. So
okay, it'd be interesting to explore the question of why is it hard now?
Let's do that. Because I think that's something that we could learn something about beyond just the current situation. Right? Like, what is it about now that makes it hard? So where would be the first place you would go?
Well, let's look at what everybody knows. Everybody knows that, and I say everybody knows in inverted commas, because just because it's a story that we all tell ourselves doesn't mean it's true. But the story that everybody, the story we're all telling ourselves is this: we are facing a pandemic of historic proportions. We all have been told to stay indoors. People are going to die in large quantities, unless we all stay at home. And even then, people are going to die in large quantities. The economy is going to shut down and is shutting down. And as a consequence, bad things are going to happen economically. But we're going to have to live with that because the alternative is lots of people dying. That's basically where we are right now. Nobody can tell you with any sort of accuracy or any sort of, not even accuracy, nobody can tell you how much of that story is true. They just can't. Nobody can tell you they can't even tell you whether the first bit of it is really true. If that's the story, we are in the middle of a plague, and that plague is of Florentine proportions, and we're all going to have to lock ourselves in our rooms and not commune with each other. And I picked up a phrase yesterday that I never thought that I would read in my lifetime: the unfortunate but necessary cessation of general commerce nationwide. The unfortunate but necessary cessation. It's not tapering off. This is not reductions. This is cessation of general commerce nationwide. I never thought I would read that, but that's what we have. So, what does that mean for leadership, or what does that do for the state of mind of people who are in positions of leadership? Firstly, it creates unbelievable amount of uncertainty as to the outcome. Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, it makes it appear as though the outcome is inevitable and it's going to be awful. That creates a natural flight response from us. We want to get out of that situation. And we start thinking as business owners we start extrapolating into the disaster what that means for us personally, for our solvency, for our families, for our ability to provide. We are absolutely superb. Our thinking machines are superb at extrapolating into disaster. Once we get on that horse, we can gallop it for miles deep into the forest. And at the same time, that doesn't actually get us anywhere because none of it is true. There are elements of it that we can observe. Yes, people are staying at home, but at the same time, there are certain businesses that are booming at the moment. Anybody with an e-commerce site at the moment is booming, as long as they can get hold of product. There are some businesses that are deeply and negatively impacted. A friend of mine who runs a great business, fabulous business in Ann Arbor, said he had to lay off 300 people yesterday or the day before, out of a staff of 500, of whom about 50 are partners, in various aspects of the business. So of the 450 people who aren't partners, 300 are now at home and drawing unemployment benefit. That is heartbreaking. As I say, so that's the challenge. So if we're asking why is this a difficult time, it's a difficult time because there seems to be a clear narrative that this is a disaster, that we're on the brink of an economic downturn that could easily turn into a depression. We're surrounded, even if you just take the macro view that, that the economy is being flooded with liquidity. Mm. Where's all the money coming from? How's it ever going to be paid back? How do you as a leader stand up in front of your people and say anything that is going to make you, that doesn't have the risk attached to it of making you look really stupid or really naive in 24 hours, 48 hours or a week? So we're faced with potential disaster. And then I suppose the question also comes up, what's the point? You know, what's the, if we're all going over a cliff, what's the point in, you know, in putting a tie on and going to work in the morning? Because nothing I can do is going to make the blindest bit of difference. We're all doomed.
Yeah.
So that's the situation that in which leadership now has to step up and do something. Would you agree?
I agree. And a couple of the things that I hear in there that I would just highlight are tremendous amounts of uncertainty. And I realized quite a while ago that I was willing to sell myself out for certainty. And, you know, I just had zero ability to be with uncertainty. And this was in times that were, you know, far more certain. I was having a hard time financially and in my business and things, but it was a much more certain time in general. And I realized just how much I was willing to sell myself out and sell myself short and give up when it came to trading that for some sort of certainty. And I keep going back to what I came up with in that time. Now I spend mental effort reminding myself to find some way to be at ease with uncertainty. And when there's this much uncertainty, I think it is just very, very natural for people to have a very hard time being at ease with this amount of uncertainty. And so I'm not saying I succeed all the time, but I do keep bringing myself back to that.
Go
ahead.
But isn't this an amazing opportunity to understand the wisdom in the phrase of being present?
Yes.
And it sounds like such, you know, you hear it, to be present, you've got to be grateful, you've got to be, and it's, and you think, yada, yada, that's all sort of yoga mantra. And it sounds great, and I'm present. Where's my phone?
Let me check the news sites real quick.
What it means is if I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, because I just don't know. I mean, we don't know. We do not know what's going to happen tomorrow. A month ago, we were pretty sure we did know what was going to happen tomorrow, and the week after that, and in the next year. So we would plan for that, and we would feel safe within the structures of our planning. Today, we have to acknowledge, because it's been rammed down our throats, and we're sitting at home, hopefully not in our pajamas at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but we are at home and we are in quarantine. We've been locked down and nothing is certain. Nobody knows anything. So isn't this a great time to acknowledge the very, very, the dramatic curtailment of our planable time horizon? And just to say, actually, getting through today is fine, because I've no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm probably going to be sitting here, but I don't know what's going to change tomorrow. I don't know whether it's going to be better or worse. I just don't know. So what does that mean? That means being aware of where I am right now and reducing the amount of time over which I think I have to have some sort of control down to the immediate present. And that means that instead of figuring out what I am going to do, I need to just concentrate on what I am doing.
Yes.
And that difference between what I'm going to do and what I am doing, completely divorced from what I was doing, because what I was doing yesterday is irrelevant. You know, when we last saw each other at the beginning of March, that seems like 100 years away. Who cares what we were doing then? All the parameters have changed. And what we see in a crisis like this is, firstly, what a dynamic situation we're in, number one. Number two, how all the variables can correlate to one at times of stress. When there's no such thing as diversification of returns in a crisis. There just isn't. You know, everybody in portfolio theory, there's all this theory about, you know, gold. Gold works in a different way to treasury bonds, which work in a different way to stocks, which work in a different way to this, which work in a but in a crisis, it's all bullshit because everything goes down at the same time. Mm. So the correlation at the very time when you need it most or think you need it most is one. Now, everything is perfectly correlated because everything that can be sold will be, and everything comes under the pressure at roughly the same time. So in a world in which those variables are dynamic, and in a crisis they all tend to correlate, the only thing you can focus on is what you are doing right now. And that's when leadership comes in, because you get to make a choice. You get to make a choice. You get to make a choice of how to be at any one particular time, how to respond, how to act, what to focus on. And it has a huge impact on the outcome.
Yeah. Sir Stephen, what you just said is so key, and it reminds me of something. And I want to step in. So first of all, I want to say that in the show notes, I will put a link to Leadership in the Time of COVID-19, which is your beautiful play on love in the time of cholera. And, I think it's a great read. I just got it, so I haven't finished it yet, but it's beautiful. The first bit and the outline make me certain that I'm going to sit down and read this ASAP, and I would love for people to have it. And what you just said, who are you going to be in this time? It's so key. And I remember the first time that I ever realized that what we are called is human beings. And I think times of crisis like this, and really, I think it's not an exaggeration to say unprecedented times like this in my lifetime and yours as well, bring down the focus to that. We are human beings. And I think we treat ourselves like we're human doings. What am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? And when it's brave to stay at home so that you're not, you know, sharing this around and killing even more people. And it's tough to figure out how to be, right? Bravery usually looks like rushing towards the sound of the battle. Right now, I think bravery is actually being willing to stay home and not do that. And so that question of who are you being, I think, is a really interesting question. And what you say about being present, it's just so key and so important.
Well, and I do that not as a spiritual practice. Leave that to one side. It's simply a question of how can I reduce the amount of time in which I have to plan and think to the healthiest level. And it just happens to be when all the variables are firing in all sorts of different directions, the only thing you can really control is how you show up now, what you do now. And there are also in the book, and that little ebook that I wrote was meant to be a guide or a selection of stuff that you can do every day right now that will build and put you in I hope, much stronger position for whatever comes, you know. And I'm going to be quite banal now to say either this works out okay or it doesn't. If it doesn't work out okay, what have you lost by being as good as you can be today? And if it does work out okay, you will be starting from pole position.
Yes, very good. Now that brings me to the I think you called it the XY theory. So we've got about 10 minutes before we've got to go. I know we have a hard stop, but I would love to hear about that theory and apply it to times like this.
Your focus in this series of interviews that you're doing in your podcast is about leadership and communication. And my own take on that, and I've thought about this hard in the couple of days running up to our conversation, is that how you communicate depends very much on how you view other people. In other words, what is your picture of other people? Because how I see people determines, as a leader, how I think I need to talk to them. And there's quite a neat way of grouping people, particularly in organizations. And it's called the theory X and theory Y. And theory X says people dislike work, find it boring, and avoid it if they can. People must be forced or bribed to make the right effort. People would rather be directed than accept responsibility, which they try to avoid. People are motivated mainly by money and fears about job security. And people have little creativity except when it comes to getting around rules. That's sort of the theory Y, a theory X view of the world. The theory Y view of the world is the opposite of that. And it says people need to work and want to take an interest in it. And on the right conditions, they enjoy it. People will direct themselves towards a target that they accept. People will seek and accept responsibility under the right conditions. Under the right conditions, people are motivated by the desire to realize their own potential. And creativity and ingenuity are widely distributed and grossly underused. So that's the theory Y. The theory Y is that people want to learn, they want to take responsibility, they're creative, and that they will bring their very best to the party under the right conditions. Okay. Yes. And the right condition is that you believe that they want to do that and you create an atmosphere in which they believe it.
Yes. You
know? So, and that, funnily enough, is leadership. Leadership is creating the safe space in which people can take responsibility, take interest, become creative, become responsible, and are motivated and believe that that effort will be rewarded and acknowledged in all sorts of different ways. And theory X says everybody is basically trying to game the system, so they need to be coerced and bribed and beaten. You know? And depending on which of those two pictures of humanity you have, where you are on that continuum, will determine how you communicate.
I think it's really true. And you know, the two things that brings up for me. One is just the idea of Freudian projection, seeing in other people what's really going on over here inside you. And that's made it a lot easier for me to deal with the downside of social media and these people. You know, I just look at Twitter accounts and Facebook posts and things and ask myself, you know, okay, what's their worldview they're projecting on everybody? What they're accusing everyone else of is what they're actually guilty of. And then the other thing that it brings up for me is a study that I read about quite a while ago where they just randomly grouped children. It makes me cry, actually, because I have a 3.5-year-old myself right now, but I think it applies to human beings across the board. But they grouped children into two groups, and then they told just randomly, and then they told teachers, oh, these are the good kids and these are the bad kids. You know how it turned out?
Yeah.
Those were good kids. Those were the bad kids. But that's because the teacher was putting their expectation on that, had nothing to do with who the kids actually were. And I think that's a huge, huge leadership lesson.
Yeah, I agree.
People get what they expect, you know? And if you can manage to expect the best of your people, especially in times like this, when it's really scary and people might be acting a little differently than they usually act and might be a little more afraid and, you know, need a little more handholding and whatever. If you can just remember to talk to them like they're great, no matter how they might be being in that moment, I think it's just going to go better.
There is a little sentence from Karl Popper who said, optimism is a moral imperative of leadership.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's,
and a moral imperative means if you're standing up in front of people, and that doesn't mean you have to lie to them, but you have to have faith.
Yes.
You have to have faith that doing what we're doing will lead to a better outcome than not doing anything.
Yeah. Do you know Ben Zander? Have I ever pointed that TED talk out to you. So Ben Zander is a conductor in Boston, is one of my big heroes. His talk is the reason that I finally just pulled out all the stops and made my way to TED. I saw his talk that he gave in 2008, and I was there in 2009 because of it. But he says, you know, it's very important for a leader to believe in the people he's leading. Imagine if Martin Luther King had said, "I have a dream, but I'm not really sure you're up to it." You know, it's just, things would have been different. So, I just really appreciate you joining me and sharing your wisdom. And I will have links to everything we talked about in the show notes. And I certainly hope that you'll come back again and again and chat with us. And is there anything?
If you'll have me, I would be delighted.
Of course.
If anybody, I do have a call out. If anybody wants a copy of my collection of little essays around what to do in these strange times, called Leadership in the Time of COVID-19, they can go to goodandprosper.com, and I will swap it for your email. Give me your email and you can download the copy from the link that you will get automatically from that site.
Fabulous. Yeah, I'll make sure that link is in the show notes, and I think it's highly worthwhile. And I would give you an email that I check regularly because I would want to hear what you have to say after that too.
Okay. Thank you, John.
So thank you. Well, so thank you. Yeah, you too. You know, I'm sure I'll talk to you again soon. It sure has been nice to have this conversation. Thanks for your thoughts on communication and leadership, Sir Stephen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And I will look forward to being with you all again soon.
Thank you. Take care, John. Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too. Take care. Bye, Stephen.
Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.